Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene the Science Forum. We do this about every month or so. It's kind of a loose schedule, as the scientists will surely gripe about. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Now, our producer, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall, not in the building at this moment, so there are a number of ways you can contact us. I'll give you a couple of easy ones. There's, of course, the phone number, and then I'll check the email here from my handy mobile device. It's voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, if you want to email. You can also tweet us at WAMC Radio using the hashtag VoxPop. Going to be a little tougher for me to check that one. But Facebook, also a possibility, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. There's a VoxPop post there. But, yeah, let's do the phone, 1-800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. With all that taken care of, let's meet the panel.
Ooh, I get to go first. I'm Barbara Brabets from SUNY Cobleskill. I teach in the coming up semester. Ooh. I am teaching all things chemistry, general chemistry, and organic chemistry.
That's exciting.
But I am a biochemist.
So are you excited for the start of the school year?
I'm so excited.
Wait a minute. You really are excited.
I am excited. Right, I was on sabbatical, so now I get to see students.
Oh, that's great.
Just ask me when I have a pile of grading if I'm excited.
And?
I'm Ivor Gaber. I work for Applied Biophysics.
Well, nice to have you back. It's been a while, Ivor.
Yeah, and I'm also excited because I don't teach anymore.
I think
no pile of grading for Ivor.
I'm with you there. And?
Ed Stander, SUNY Cobleskill, geology, astronomy, anything that Barbara or Ivor can't answer. And I'm also picking up signals by my oral network. If anybody wants to send me something over the brainwaves, I can pick that up as well.
Oh, I thought you meant your fillings.
Well, no, I don't use my fillings anymore because I've lost too many teeth.
Okay, so, all right. Well, I think I brought this up before on a science forum. When I was growing up, there was an AM radio station about eighth of a mile from my house.
Same one that was by my house.
WOKO, right. Yep. 1460, right? Okay, and I swear we had central air. You know, the ducts were in the floorboards.
Yeah.
I swear to you that I could pick up the radio station on the metal grate.
Grates.
Yeah, is that possible?
And the transmitter was near your house?
Yeah.
It was a block away from my house, and I can tell you, I picked it up on my fillings, no question.
Really? Ivor, are we crazy?
Country music, I don't know.
It's my opinion.
But I swear to you, it happened. At that time, I was not a country music fan.
Right.
Now I kind of, that old school country that they played in the 70s was...
Brings you right back, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, every time, on the telephone, I'm sure the same thing with you. With the telephone, every time somebody called, you got okay country, much louder than you got the person at the other end.
If the ground situation in the house was good. Yeah, very good. All right, well, the phones, miraculously, are starting to light up. The number to call, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Barry, who is on the road, but is from Scotia Glenville, if you're scoring at home. Hello, Barry.
Hi there. I have two questions. The one that I originally asked, which was, in the 95% of the universe that has no matter in it, I believe it's called dark space, does Einstein's time-space continuum exist? And what effect does it have if there's no matter for it to interact with? And the second one, for the chemistry lady, is which is more important to chemistry, the molecule or the atom? And if so, why?
Do you want to hang on the line or do you want to listen on the radio?
I'll hang on the line.
All right.
I'll hang on the line.
All right, so let's do this whole time-space continuum thing.
Yeah, let's do the big before we do the small.
Okay.
You know, they're both the same considering it's all molecules.
Well, first, right? Now, Barry starts by saying that the universe is 95% nothing. First of all, is that true?
Probably not.
So there is
That's what I've heard.
That's what you've heard.
The physicists have said that, yeah.
Well, we have a physicist here on the... On the panel. But there's some question about whether there's stuff out there that we can't detect, right?
Right. That's been changed. That number's been changing a lot in the last two decades, really. The 95% number.
Yeah, but even there's still questions since we've never actually caught anything that is dark matter, if you will. We still don't even know if it exists.
Okay.
We know mathematically that it may exist.
We know mathematically that physics doesn't work very well at large scales.
Correct.
And that may exist.
I don't agree with all of this.
Okay. All right.
Here we go.
Now we got Ivor. Go ahead, Ivor.
Why wouldn't mathematics work on a large scale? Well, and furthermore, the way the universe work is that they can tell from the galaxies that there are more matter there than you can say. So if gravity is the same everywhere, which it may not be, then there must be some other matter there.
Okay, so the big if is gravity uniform in its action?
That is not known, but everybody assumes so.
And that right. could be a scale factor, which is what I said.
Well, which means that our mathematical equations may not accurately represent all of space and time. And that's where the error might be. Remember when you used to do the division and you had the remainder? And
yeah.
You didn't know what to do with it?
Right.
That's dark matter.
Yeah, that's why I'm in radio today, by the way. Not all that good in that. All right, so the second part of Barry's question had to do with...
atoms and molecules.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Which is more important?
Which is more important, the chicken or the egg?
I think it was the electron and the atom, wasn't it?
No, it was atom and molecules, right, Barry?
What's that?
Atoms versus molecules was your second question?
Yes, I thought that the basic, most chemistry has various formula for calculating chemical interaction. I thought they would deal with molecules.
Well,
am I right?
You know, they're both right. So, Ivor, your take on the atom.
I would say that in chemistry, molecules are much more important than the atoms. There are only 92 atoms, and there are infinite number of chemical compounds.
Right.
Okay.
So the 92 atoms, we think of it like, I'm sorry, I'm yelling at Barry now, are like keys on the piano keyboard. There's 88 keys on the keyboard. There's 92 different atoms. Each one has a characteristic that's different than the others. In the same way that there's an infinite number of concertos and bad bar songs and Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, there's all of these things that can be used with the combination of those 88 keys on a piano. Well, the same can be said of chemistry. So the combinations of those atoms gives us much more diversity and seems to be responsible for this spontaneous thing we call life.
Well, very good. Barry, thank you very much for the call. Let's go over to Richard in Richmond, Massachusetts. Richmond, you're on. No, your name is Richard, and you're also on.
Hi, guys. How are you? Thanks for taking the call.
Good.
My question is, when you're cooking something and when you get close to burning it, actually, when you remove it from the heat, it suddenly seems to smoke a ton more than when you're actually cooking it. And what is that? What is going on there?
Okay.
Can I just ask a question, Richard? Because we're trying to visualize. Smoke or steam?
Smoke.
Okay. Ed, I think you had this one not too long
ago.
Yeah,
we had this one about a month and a half, 2 months ago. Basically, what happens is that when it's on the stove, you've got superheated air going all around the thing. So you've got your pot on the stove, and then you've got superheated air going all around it. And that... how does it work?
It moves the convection. The heat moves and dissipates little areas that are hot in the top above the food. But when you turn off the heat, you slow down that convective current, and so it accumulates. So the smoke was there before, you just couldn't see it.
There's more to it than that, though.
All right.
And that's this: when the pot is on the stove, the air around the pot effectively keeps air from outside from getting inside to where the meat is. And as soon as you turn off the heat, then air from outside rushes in, and that air that rushes in, if it happens to be relatively high in water, which it normally is in the house, will immediately start to condense. And a lot of that smoke that you see is not necessarily smoke from the meat, but it's steam coming off as well.
Great.
And you get the particles stuck to the steam.
In Cummington, Mass., you're on.
Yes, I have a finger that was mashed and cut up and had to have a pin in it, and everything healed up, and the finger is perfectly, you know, relatively good, but it's scarred, and the nail is never the same as it used to be, and I'm wondering, what is the nature of scar tissue? I think about it, and I wonder, how can an injury affect DNA, because the skin is different. So how does the skin get different, form differently if the DNA of the cells or whatever are changed? So, but that doesn't make sense.
Right, because your DNA is really the same for most of the cells in your body. So even your fingernail cells versus your hair cells versus your skin cells versus your liver cells, they all have the same DNA. But how that DNA is expressed, how the tissue is differentiated, the thing that makes the liver versus skin versus tongue versus eyeball, that's the difference, right? So the basic question is, what are scars? And that's usually collagen. Collagen is a fix-it response when you have a breach in the airlock, so to speak. So it creates a scaffolding on the outside of your skin. So then over the short term, you're sealed, and over the long term, you have somewhere for stuff to grow. I don't know about the nail bed, if that can ever get fixed, but there are scar treatments now where we've understood the turning on and turning off of the signals in the cell biology, so you can make scars go away. And there's one, I think it's called scleroderma, or there's a whole host of them. You can get them by prescription or over the counter. And they work to scar heal. So if you use them for it's a long period of time, because again, you have to disassemble that scaffold and then rebuild that scaffold again.
Right.
It takes months and months and months, but you can get scars to disappear. Ira, do you want to talk some about the biophysics of building it?
I don't want to talk about that, but it seemed to me strange you didn't get the scar to disappear. And if you buy it in a drugstore, I can't believe it at all. I have a nail here which was drawn with my finger when I was like 6 years old. Mm-hmm. And he said he has to pull the nail, otherwise it will come look like a claw. And it came out like a claw even though he pulled it. So, you know.
Ah, well, so much for that.
Try it out and give us a call back in about 5 years. Let us know how it goes.
Very good. All right, thanks.
But the scar medications have really come a long way. They're quite big, good, and I'd recommend you go to the doctor and ask them.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. We'll be back.
Support for WMT comes from the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, working to permanently preserve the natural, scenic, and recreational resources of the Lake George region since 1988. LGLC.org. The Ashokan Center, a classroom in the wild where nature inspires conferences, festivals, family celebrations, and outdoor education for schools. AshokanCenter.org. The Honest Weight Food Co-op, 100 Watervliet Avenue, Albany, New York. Specializing in local and organic produce, natural groceries, fine cheeses, locally raised meats, and ready-to-go organic meals, honestweight.coop. Edgar Bosick, Certified Financial Planner, Private Financial Design, South Hadley. Your life, your plan, your portfolio, privatefinancialdesign.com. Securities through Cambridge Investment Research, member FINRA and SIPC. Stories Nursery, Freehold, New York. Featuring a variety of mums, shrubs, and trees for fall planting and bulbs for spring. Open Monday through Saturday, 8 to 5, and Sundays, 9 to 4. StoriesNursery.com. And George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts. Family owned and operated for over 75 years, serving Western Massachusetts with propane and full-service heating and plumbing installation, services, and deliveries. GeorgePropane.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. By golly, it's the Science Forum. What a great time we're having thus far.
Mm-hmm.
Don't wreck it, people. We're having a good time here. Here's a couple of emails that came in. This is from Bonnie. Panel, that's you. This week, two patents for an inflatable space elevator have been granted in Canada and the USA. Projected timeline, 3 to 5 years, out to maybe 10 to build it. In space access, this would be a game changer. Is this project fully doable with current technology, and all we need to worry about is political disinterest? Have you guys heard about this space elevator?
I haven't. It's fast. All I have right now in my head is that bubble cage that you rent for the kids with the big blower on it, and they just put it all the way up
to
the sky.
Well, you're not far off, because one of the patents is for one that is inflatable. It has.
I can barely get a snowman filled on my lawn in December with one of those blowers.
Now, it goes 12 miles. This is not one that's going to go out to geosynchronous orbit, which they also talked about in science fiction. This would go 12 miles up, and then it would have a landing strip. So it would be much easier, in theory, cost much less fuel to take off and then easier to land.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think, panel?
I have no idea what it is.
Okay.
Well, I'm not putting any money on the stock, if that's what you're thinking. I've already been hurt by Plug Parlor. Yeah, basically the idea is very simple, of course, is to have it up high enough so that the centripetal force of the Earth keeps it up there. So it's like taking a string and spinning it and keeping it outward.
But it's 12 miles, which is what, the stratosphere? Is that high enough for that centrifugal force to actually work?
Well, it'll stop friction in terms of atmospheric effects, which is the real big thing. Because a ship, in order to get out into space, has got to go 23,000 miles an hour. And, of course, the further away it gets from the Earth, that's lessened. But also you have a frictional effect of going through all that atmosphere down below.
I think it's cool to think of, but it's kind of cheating to call it space. 12 miles isn't space. That's just really high up.
That's true. But wouldn't there be tremendous possibility of things banging into it and knocking it down?
Not
but there's nothing
miles.
Up there.
Nothing there.
No. Something much lower, knocking it down. In other words, you have this elevator going up from the ground, and there are things 20,000 feet, 40,000 feet that couldn't...
Balloon goes up all the time, weather balloons.
Right, but they move.
And they don't stay up.
And they don't have a connection to the Earth.
Yeah.
I could see, like, woodpeckers stopping... Like, I'm going to hold on to this thing for a while because I'm, 20,000 feet up and the weather kind of stinks down in Bermuda. So I'm just going to wait here for a little bit. Can you imagine it?
Well, Bonnie, thanks for that email. This one's from Jim in Montgomery. Dear Ray and the scientists, here's one I hope is new for the panel. This morning's news feed showed the picture of a fire rainbow, which was seen in South Carolina yesterday. It is beautiful, but can the panel explain what the heck it is? Now, this is a black and white that he sent, so it doesn't really do it much justice. But I don't know if you guys saw that in the news yesterday.
Looks like a cloud.
Yeah, it has a little prism effect.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, well.
We're passing a paper
passing
around.
Passing it around, and I'll have
radio.
A drink of coffee. And whenever you want to weigh in, go ahead.
Well, rainbow effectively is light bouncing off of particles in the atmosphere. And depending on the size of the particles, it will bounce off or it won't bounce off. And in the case of water, it's able to get into the droplet, and it comes back as a prism. So there's no reason why it wouldn't happen in a fire where there's an awful lot of humidity in the air as a result of the fire itself.
And again, those darn particles, like with the smoke on the stove, you get the particles in the water together, so they get suspended. And again, that just
the water nucleates on the particles.
Exactly. So it's a place. That's why if you have a really, really, really dry summer, it's very hard to get any rain there because there's nothing to be the nucleation site, the place where the water joins.
If it's a fiery rainbow, it must be. Normally, rainbows are caused by the sun, but this fire is just very lot of light. You can get a rainbow from a fire.
All right, back to the phones we go. It is Colin's turn in Springfield, Massachusetts. Colin, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. Good segue to my question with the rainbow. For many, many, many years, I have made pilgrimages up to Bar Harbor. Mm-hmm. And as you probably are aware, atop of Cadillac Mountain is the first place in the United States where the sun rises. And in the morning, or pre-dawn, I should say, there are many people up there, and they watch for the green flash.
Right.
And I've been there many times, and I think I have seen it a few times.
Right.
But, I ask myself, why isn't there ever a picture of it?
Oh, there are lots of pictures online.
Of green flash?
Oh, there are, okay.
Of the green flash, yeah.
Okay, what is it?
Ray's checking.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
Do you want to take it, Ivor, or should I take it?
I don't know how, of course, it's a green flash. I heard a lot about it, but I've never seen it.
Effectively, what happens is as the sun rises or sets, it goes through the lower atmosphere. And as a result, there's a lot of refraction because there's a lot of material in the lower atmosphere, just like there is in a rainbow. And there, you can actually sometimes, very often, when you see the sun set, the sun is already set, actually. But what's happened is you're seeing the light refracting off that lower layer. Especially when it's very hotter, there's an inversion at near the horizon. And what happens is the light gets reflected off of that towards you. So, again, if you see the sun set, the sun may have already set at that point. And sometimes you get a mirage within that little zone. Mm. And that mirage is green because it's between the blue and the red, effectively. You get a prism effect. And the longest period of time, and the part that your eye can see the easiest, is the green spectrum.
And Ed, doesn't it happen mostly at sunset because you need that heat effect as opposed to the warming of sunrise?
It'll happen,
but of course, in Bar Harbor, you're not going to see the sunset.
Right. It happens on either case. It depends on whether you've got that inversion layer.
Right.
And you've got a mirage effect, effectively. In fact, there are lots of pictures online of the green flash, and there's lots of pictures. For example, you see the sun, and then you see a little layer above the sun. which is effectively the mirage of the sun, and that's the part that gives the green flash.
Aha.
And so you have to have a flat horizon, really, to see it, too.
You have to be able to see out a long way.
Yep.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that call. We appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Very quickly, this one came in. There was no text in the actual message portion, but this was in the subject heading, and I missed it. This is from Abigail. Please explain the concept, evaporation is refrigeration. That's from Abigail.
Well, expansion is refrigeration, not evaporation per se. But when materials expand, they become exothermic and they lose heat. Correct, Barb?
When they are exothermic, they lose heat, yes.
That's right. And so, for example, in a refrigerator, the way it works is you've got a compressor which effectively takes heat out of one environment, and then you've got a condenser which expands it, and then that removes the heat. So there's two parts to it. So basically, that I think that's what she's probably
talking
about. Yes,
you have to have two. If you don't have two, you don't get it. That's why you can't run an air conditioner inside a house without an exhaust to the outside, because you can't create those two zones.
And you've got to get rid of the heat somehow.
Right. It's a reverse of a refrigerator, really.
It's called adiabatic expansion, if you want to look it up.
All right, let's go to Lou in Altamont. Lou, you're up.
Yes, there's certain foods, at least I'm going to stick with foods, that have the ability to hold cold excessively or hold heat. An example would be a tomato juice. Mm-hmm. Very cold tomato juice seems to just give you brain freeze immediately. What allows those materials to have that property?
Well, the property's name is specific heat capacity, or sometimes just called heat capacity. So, I mean, it's not really a sexy name, but it certainly does describe the issue. Metals tend to have really low heat capacity, so they heat up and cool down very quickly. And if one heats up quickly, one cools down quickly. They go together. Mm-hmm. And the one we use as the poster child of a high heat capacity is water. Water takes a long time to heat up, and it takes a long time to cool down. That's why at night when you jump in a lake like Lake George in the middle of the fall, the sand on the beach will be really cool because it has a low heat capacity, but the water itself will be warmer than the air temperature because it has a high heat capacity. So tomato juice has, of course, a lot of water in it, but also it has those particles in it which give it a kind of a denser, mushy consistency. I know that mushy is not on my periodic table.
Term.
I know.
Yeah.
It's terrible. If you were to put, I'm making myself homework and I haven't even started school.
Well,
but
fantastic.
If I do OJ and tomato juice side by side, and if I had pulpy OJ and pulpy tomato juice, I bet they would cool down at the same rate and heat up at the same rate.
Oh, very interesting. Well, that's a great call, Lou.
Thank you. Water is one of the best things.
Water is the
pure
best
water.
Heat capacity.
Yeah. How about gin?
No. Actually, ethanol. Well, cheap gin, yes. Oh. Not good gin.
Well, if you put the gin in the freezer, it tends to stay cold pretty long.
It does, but it doesn't
freeze.
But
not as cold.
I mean, I'm told. I don't know this for sure. But
I've been told that if you take some stainless containers in the freezer, they tend to keep their heat or cold, in this case, a lot longer, so they're much better for
Again,
drinks.
I've seen some scientific journals that have mentioned this.
I saw a catalog on a plane once.
All right, let's go back to the phones before I get into further trouble. Let's go to Mark in Schenectady. Mark.
Hi, I have something a little bit closer to home. I have a hot tub, and also this relates to my garden. I was discussing with someone, believe it or not, about pH. Is the term pH, what exactly is it? And a gardener of mine mentioned that pH can affect growth in a garden as well. Is that true or untrue? And what is pH?
Okay, so I'll start with what is, and then I'll answer the second question about soil and effect of pH. So pH is...
Oh, boy. Okay. We're going to just let you listen on the radio there, Mark.
pH is... Remember those logs, that button on a tape? Yeah. Oh, gosh. It's an exponentially driven unit, a conversion unit from concentration. So,
oh, God. You don't want to ask a chemist this.
Gosh.
This is a bad question.
So acid... we kind of point to acid as hydrogen ions, H+ ions.
Mm-hmm.
And the negative log of the hydrogen ion concentration is the definition of pH, and the geologist is like, not math.
Okay.
Anyway, look, so it's an exponent scale. So if your pH goes up one unit or down one unit, you've actually increased or decreased your concentration by 10. So that's big. I mean, I wish my paycheck did that,
yeah.
Right? So if I have a soil pH of 6 versus a soil pH of 7, 6 has 10 times more acid in it than 6.
Hmm.
So it's a big deal when your pH changes. So soil is very pH dependent. Just slightly acidic is what you want. So just on the between 6.5 and 7 is where you'd like your soil pH, because that's usually what plants want.
But not all plants.
No, not all plants. Tomatoes like it a little bit less.
Yeah.
So they like a little bit. They're a little more hoggy with their H plus ions. So they want it down around 6.
Yeah.
Pine trees like it a little less. Blueberry likes it a little less. So there's websites, and the Cornell Cooperative Extension can tell you what your pH should be in your soils.
Right, you are. All right, back to the phones at Luke and Troy. Luke.
Hi. I have a question about solar radiation management. Seeing how you guys have already been talking a little bit about ice nuclei and cloud formation. So as you probably know, the UN set this goal for global warming to not let it go above 2 degrees Celsius. But the same group from the UN said that we're really not likely to do that with carbon dioxide reduction alone. So could you guys talk a bit about the different technologies for solar radiation management to help with that besides carbon dioxide reduction?
What do you mean, like mirrors in space?
But I don't know what they mean by solar radiation management. We don't manage the solar radiation. That has anything to do with the Earth. And as far as the global warming is concerned, the temperature hasn't gone up for roughly 20 years. So I don't think that's a big problem either.
So the RGGI, which is the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and some other organizations that my colleagues just love, have this formula. It's really this awful-looking formula based on what seems to be empirical evidence from the experiments, of what contributes and what takes from the heat load on the Earth. And so one of the big question marks, Luke, is cloud cover, because cloud cover can be reflective. Right. If you get clouds, you're not going to be necessarily as warm on that day down on the ground than you would be if the clouds weren't there. But then clouds also have the ability to insulate.
Like Venus.
Well, yeah, like Venus, or like us on a cloudy day in January. It's going to be warmer on a cloudy day in January than a clear day in February. And that's called the albedo effect. And I think the biggest issue we have with solar radiation management is we don't have a full handle on the dynamics of cloud cover and how that's going to affect temperatures on the planet. Can we regulate clouds? Not really, but we can interpret what processes we do as humans that may increase or decrease cloud cover.
Haven't they been trying to regulate clouds, or at least increase clouds, for decades? I know the Chinese still try.
You know, there are programs that have done that. NOAA had some experiments on trying to get precipitation to happen. It happens. But we can't, right? You got a cycle of the sun that's a decade plus more years long, and we're going to just say to the sun, we're going to ignore you for when you're at your solar max. Sorry about that. Just doesn't work like that.
Wasn't much of a solar max this last
time. No, there wasn't. But there's something else that's just coming out just recently I'd read about, that the sun seems to have two main currents operating in it, one of which is below surface and one which is at the surface. And if they operate in consort, then the sun is hotter than normal. And if they operate against each other, then the sun is less hot than normal.
Mm, interesting.
And effectively, what's been happening is they figured by matching our temperature measurements on the Earth over the past couple of years, they figured that by 2020 to 2030, we're going to be in a period of solar minimum, which means that it's actually going to be cooler than normal. And again, it's the sun. It's the sun that does it, really. You have to worry about that.
All right, let's get another call in here before the next break. And Jonathan in Gill, Massachusetts. Jonathan.
Hey, I've got a question about honeybees.
Okay.
I just recently planted some yellow daylilies. This is the first time I've sort of observed this, but I would notice every day that inside the flower of these daylilies was like 5 or 6 honeybees in every single flower.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like they were actively collecting flour, they were just sort of drunk or drowsy. And in the meantime, really close by were orange daylilies, and they didn't have any honeybees in them. So I the question is, why do they prefer the yellow? What were they doing in there? And do bees get drunk on pollen?
Well, I'll start with why do they prefer one over the other. It's not necessarily that they prefer the yellow over orange, although we all have our own preferences. I like orange myself. However, what happens is when you have an explorer bee go out and find a new pollen source, they then go back and relay the navigational information to others that don't have anything to collect. And then they go as a convoy together. So one of those bees was probably the sentinel bee out to go figure out where's some pollen, and it had a preference for the yellow. And then the others followed it, and when they act drunken like that, they're moving their tails behind, because that's what's the little hairs on their tails are what collects the pollen. And the way that they grab that, and then they head back into the honeycomb, the hive. But the drunkenness, I think we're going to get to in a second.
No, I'm not going to talk about the drunkenness because we've already been there.
You have 30 seconds before the break.
But I do want to mention that the honeybee probably does not see the same colors that we are seeing.
That's right.
They're really seeing ultraviolet more than anything else. And as such, the yellow flowers may have a bigger marker on them that tells them that those are the better flowers to be to.
All right.
And that first sentinel might have said, hey, cool.
All right. Now, can you get bent on pollen?
You can.
You can?
Yes.
Okay. And how can you tell? Do they sing?
Well, it's the same thing as mead.
Okay. Well, there you go, Jonathan. You
Thank
ask
you
a scientist,
much.
You get an answer. Flippant, but an answer. It's just about time for our break. 1-800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, don't you know? Home stretch coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. AshfieldStone.com. Sheehy Opticians, Albany, New York. Providing eyeglasses, including Bevel, Lafont, and Pro Design. Progressive lenses and Verilux and Nikon. And Maui Jim, Costa, and Ray-Ban sunglasses. Sheehy Opticians.com. Manny's TV and Appliances. Family-owned since 1977, now offering olive oil from his vineyards in Crete. Available at Atkins, River Valley Market, Randall's, Foster's, and Big Y grocery stores, mannysoliveoil.com. Curtis Lumber, working to support their communities through their Pet Connection sponsorship and by providing professional services and supplies to owners and contractors, curtislumber.com. Colby Attorneys Service, document filing, document and information retrieval, and other services including legal publishing and corporate record searches, ColbyService.com. And SPAC, presenting the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center for 6 performances through August 25th at the Spa Little Theater, SPAC.org for tickets.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551, the Science Forum, Ed Stander, Ivor Gaver, and Barbara Brabitz here today, and yours truly, Ray Graff. This one came in via email. This is from Susan. A thought of you, Ray, today being Radio Day. Today's Radio Day. Who knew?
Hallelujah.
Maybe we should spin some records by the Shirelles coming up on the program.
That would be nice.
Yeah, would that be nice? All right, this email came from Ron in Kingston. 88% of scientists are pro-GMO. But only 37% of the general public is pro-GMO. How does the science panel, you guys, stand on the GMO controversy?
Well, there's three of us, so it'll probably be either 66% or 100%.
All right, well, let's just go to it.
I teach an environmental ethics course, basically. And amongst that, we talk about GMOs for about 2 weeks. So in order to distill 2 weeks down into 30 seconds.
Or less.
Right. Thank you, Ray. I have no problem with GMOs as long as the technology is open, that there's labeling for the citizen so that they know what they're getting, and the benefit of the GMO it has something other to do with, like, it can't be frivolous. It needs to be either to increase the resilience of the crop or extend the growing season or allow it to be drought resistant. Those are the types of things that can save this growing planet and its population. We're very lucky. We don't have problems getting food. That's why we're all fat in America. But other places, not so much.
Hmm.
So I would say that GMO is the most wonderful thing. And unfortunately, in Europe, they don't use genetic modified food. And they should. And I'm just signed a statement about putting something called golden rice, which is rice with A vitamins in it. And there are roughly 300 million people in this world who don't get enough A vitamins, but they eat rice. So if they use genetically modified rice, maybe a few million people in Africa would be saved every year. But the Europeans don't want it. They have worked on it for like 12, 15 years, and they want to improve it.
Mm.
So genetically modified food is a wonderful thing.
And my 33% would be that the genetically modified food can be a wonderful thing. Unfortunately, to a very good extent, it's supporting certain companies over other companies. It's causing problems with farmers who are not allowed, for example, to save seeds. And the seeds that they do have, they have to they can't store. They have to buy every year from that certain large company that I'm not going to mention. It's probably not a major problem in terms of health, though it could be at some point, and we just don't know it.
So there are two basic objections that some people have, and one of them is purely an economic and business-oriented objection.
It's a force to be reckoned with. If you don't plant GMO crops now, then you'll lose money. And
right.
So it becomes a one-person crop, and that's a major problem.
And not to be too naive here, but when public universities and public institutions like your government do research on GMOs, then that technology is open, and those kind of baloney, that's my editorial, practices that some of the large companies have had with GMOs would disappear.
Okay. All right, let's go back to the phones, and Marco, with a different topic in Hudson. Marco, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Good, you're up.
All right, but you can save me some money on heating the pool.
Okay, your connection's pretty bad. If you're on a cell phone, I don't know, stand on a phone book or something.
Yeah, I'm trying.
Okay, go ahead.
I heat my pool with an electric heat pump. I want to know if it's better to heat it during the night or heat it during the day.
Okay.
Kind of simple. There's no difference in cost of electricity for residential electric, between night and day.
Right.
So it's strictly the...
Do you have central air in your house?
No.
Okay. Have you thought about getting central air in your house?
Well, we thought about it, but then we figured we wouldn't use the pool.
Because there are new systems that you take the central air from your house, you take the exhaust heat from your central air that cooled your house, the heat that's removed from your house then goes to warm your pool. And then I would say use it during the day, otherwise it doesn't make a difference.
It does make a difference, though, because what's not important is heat gain, but heat loss. And if you heat your water and then let it sit there, it will lose heat to the environment. So the best thing to do would be to heat it up just before you're using it. But if you're going to leave it in there, then you're going to have to, you have the question of how much insulation is there about the pool and how much heat is being lost
in
between.
And how big is the surface? How deep's your pool? Because you're only talking at the surface, Ed, that it's losing its heat, really.
Unless is it an outside pool?
It's an in-ground pool, and we use it, we use a thermal blanket on it at night, and it loses most of its heat at night.
Of course. So
it takes, it'll take hours for it to heat, maybe 4 degrees. It might take 4 to 5 hours.
Yeah, that's that heat capacity thing again.
Yeah.
A previous call, Marco. Sorry.
If you're leaving your pool, if you're using it all the time, then it really doesn't make a difference because the heat's
okay.
There no matter what.
Okay.
If you're just heating it then to use it as in a hot tub, for example, you'd be better off heating it before you use it.
So it's the same principle as the new on-demand hot water heaters?
Effectively, if you had one of those, you'd be in good shape.
Okay. Ivor, you want to weigh in?
I think the pool is much too big for on-demand water heater, And
right.
I think it doesn't make much difference what you do.
All right. And
you
had another question, Marco, I see on the list?
Yep.
Okay.
My, My second question is kind of a silly one, but it always bothered me. You see soda vending machines outside all year round. So when you have, like, you know, 5-10 degrees below zero in the winter, does a heater come on and actually to keep the soda from freezing?
It's actually, well, it depends on how crappy your vending machine is, but they do make them where they just have a constant icebox principle. So they keep them at 4 Celsius, which is about 40 degrees, which is what you want your soda usually at. And it's 4 Celsius. It has the ability to remove heat or to add heat, just like we're talking about with these other systems.
I love that question. Thank you, Marco. And over to Jack in Glenville. Jack.
Hi. So I got a question about time dilation.
Oh, good.
I know that when you approach speed of light, time essentially kind of slows down from some reference point. But I also remember learning that that's only effective in non-inertial reference frames. So my question is, when people talk about traveling through space and using time dilation to prolong life, is that actually feasible? Because at some point, you're going to have to accelerate or decelerate.
Well, it's certainly, if you are going close to the speed of light, and I'm sitting here on the Earth, you age much slower than I do as far as I'm concerned. But I guess when you, in your place, you look at the Earth and you think that the opposite is true. So, but it's certainly true that as far as the Earth is concerned, if you, for example, somebody had flown around the Earth and they have set the clock, and the clock is slower when they get back than the regular time.
But they've still traveled by whatever their internal frame of reference is.
Yeah, but I mean, you can, even with an airplane, you travel fast enough to slow you down.
I guess, but my question is, so if your clock is slowing down while you're traveling so fast, when you come to slow down, does your clock then speed up to match back with the time of reference from the Earth?
Yeah, it would go back. If you land on Earth, then the clock would be going the same as all the clocks on Earth.
Okay.
But see, if you have a clock on an airplane and go around the Earth once, that clock, when you come back, it goes slow. It's slower. There's a fraction of a second which I've lost.
Well, Jack, thanks a lot for that call. This one came in via email from Linda, who says, a shout-out to Barbanette and SUNY Cobleskill, 99 and counting. What is that, 99 years old?
99 years we've been in business at SUNY Cobleskill.
You look pretty young.
Thank you.
That's time dilation.
It's the time dilation.
All right, well, here's a question.
We hope Linda is doing better.
Linda has this question from Sloansville. A question about obtaining natural gas by drilling deep into the earth. The latest technological advance in capturing natural gas uses gelled propane instead of water to bring the natural gas to the surface. What happens to the gelled propane? What sort of after effects, good or bad, occur when using this technique? And that's, again, from Linda in Sloansville.
Geologist.
I haven't even heard about yeast and gelled propane, but I can understand
why
they
delicious.
Use it. Yeah, well, basically, what you're trying to do with the material is open up the pores in the earth. And the idea, I imagine, of gelled propane is that once it gets in there, you don't have to pump it back out again and deal with it. So it would wind up opening up all the pores in the earth to allow the natural gas to get out. And then you'd also have propane as well.
Right. So you don't have wastewater.
There's no wastewater, right.
Because you can burn it because propane's flammable. So you get the natural gas mixed with the propane. And so you're kind of like priming the natural gas to come out of the ground. The other thing is that propane is a nonpolar molecule. And the natural gas is also nonpolar. Water is polar. So natural gas doesn't want to go in water. That's why it bubbles when it comes out of your tap. So you want to solubilize and get them to dissolve within each other. So like dissolves like. Nonpolar will dissolve nonpolar, and propane's nonpolar.
Mm. Okay, well, that was a nice email. Thank you very much. Back to the phones we go. And Chet in East Leverett, Flats, Massachusetts. You're on.
Hi, Ray and scientists.
Hello.
Last program, and again today, there was a talking about what you see above the pot on the stove.
Yeah.
And your geologist, I believe he is, said that what you're seeing is steam.
It's condensation from the air around the pot.
And what I wanted to point out is that steam is invisible. You don't see steam. What you see is water vapor, which
that's
is
right.
a liquid it's, form of water.
It's condensed steam is what I meant, yes.
All right, water. Chet, 1 point for you.
Oh, come on. Right.
Thank you very much for that. Let's go over to Bill in Greenville. Bill.
Hi there.
Hello.
So my question is regarding double rainbows.
All right.
And every time I've ever seen a double rainbow, they're inverse from each other. So if the violet was at the bottom of the main rainbow, it would be at the top of the other rainbow. And I'm wondering what creates that phenomenon. Is it actually a reflection of the main rainbow, or?
No, Ed, this is yours. You do this all the time.
Go ahead.
Oh, for somebody do it.
Oh,
the show's almost over.
Oh, you're right. So, again.
What'd you say, Bill? Oh, he hung up. Okay.
Uh-oh.
Go ahead.
Okay. Bill, so a typical rainbow, you've got the prism that is the water droplet. So if we image a water droplet in our head, it's slightly triangular, right? Or pyramidal, like a pyramid. You know, that kind of thin at the top and fat at the bottom. But what if we had two of them joined together? So we had a thin at the top, a thin at the bottom, and it came to a pyramid in the middle. So we had a double-pointed droplet. And that's going to create a different prism effect than if we had a normal droplet. You take the rest.
I think we don't really know why you have that. It's well known, but I don't know it.
Hmm.
Well, basically, the reason why the two rainbows are not on top of each other is because they're reflecting off different parts of a different water molecule.
Oh, it's a different one, not within the same one.
It's not within the same one. Because if it was in the same one, then the light would be coming from the same point. But it's not. It's coming from up above or down below.
Mm. All right. I'll buy it.
And that's what you get.
Okay. And am I right in assuming you can't see a reflection of a rainbow?
Sure you can.
You can. So if you're looking over a lake, you will see a reflection of the rainbow?
If it's strong enough,
even though the rainbow, it's essentially in your eye, though, right? When you're looking at the rainbow?
Right. You're seeing the light that's refracted from the sun through the rainbow or reflected effectively into your eyeball and then refracted into the colors. And that same light, it's a very good question. I've never seen a picture of a reflected rainbow.
No, but if you held up a mirror, say you turned back to the rainbow and held up a mirror, you could still see it. So
not
it can
the same.
Reflect.
Not because, the same. Because if the water, if I'm standing on the edge of a lake, and the lake is obviously...
Oh, because it's kind of skimming the surface.
Well, it's a different angle.
Yes,
I'm looking at the,
right.
The rainbow is dependent on my angle, right?
Right.
I guess I need a high-rise cabin to be at the lake.
How many can we have? I've seen double.
I've seen triple.
I've seen triple as well. Is that the max?
There are four, but they're very rare.
And lunar rainbows. I swear to you, I was not hallucinating.
Those are called glories. And effectively what's happening there is the same thing. The light is coming from the moon and then reflecting off of ice particles or water particles in the atmosphere and coming back at you.
But are you seeing bands? In other words, if it's bright enough, will you see not colored bands, but different shades, not 50 shades, but certain number of shades of gray?
You can see that.
And
the reason why you're seeing gray is because the water particles in the clouds, as compared to being in the atmosphere, are a little bit too large to actually refract the light. There's stories of, if you go to the top of mountains, the stories of monks jumping off the top of mountains to try and enter one of these things because it was considered to be a gateway into heaven.
Yeah, I've done that. All right, let's go back to the phones. Joanna in South Hadley, you're on.
Hi there. A question I have is to ask your panelists to comment on whether geothermal heating cooling systems are actually efficient in New England.
Okay.
I've heard them advertised. I've heard one very negative review from someone who said they felt they weren't getting anything out of their system. Thank you.
Okay. Are you going to hang up? You're going to stay on?
I'll stay on, yeah.
All right. Go ahead.
Well, I can't tell you about efficiency because I haven't looked into it to a great deal, but effectively all they're doing is storing heat during the summer and then letting it go during the winter by using the earth.
This is definitely the heat show today. The
right.
heat
yeah.
show. Yeah.
Well, that's okay. Every show has a theme.
So right. The ground can warm it up or the ground can cool it down, and then the ground takes kind of part of the burden off of an air conditioner or a heat pump. So you don't have to take it from the extremes of hot or extremes of cold because the ground will keep usually you use a fluid
the specific
with geothermal.
Heat of the earth
of
is
the
quite
water
high.
In the pipe is going to have that medium temperature of 55 or so degrees. So as long as you're not getting to like minus 40, you're probably okay with geothermal as far as efficiency because the heat pumps are sized based on the extremes of heat.
All right, we're about 20 seconds away. Ivor, you want to weigh in on that?
No, not really.
Okay, well,
that was easy.
That makes it simple enough. All right, we're about done here. I don't think we have enough time to take another call. Sorry to Kate and Tom and Tom, who called in with their questions, and thanks to everybody who called in today. All right, I didn't mention your homework, but next time,
Barbara, raccoons all over the place.
It was raccoons, and I forget the question, but you remember.
Katie did's raccoons and crickets.
I had to find out why there were things disappearing in the Hudson Valley.
Okay, and you found it out.
I found out some.
And I'll get you next time.
Yep.
Thanks once again to Barbara Brabets, Ivor Gaver, and Ed Stander for being here. Thank you for listening. Thank you for calling and emailing. Good questions today. And we are just about out of time. Support comes from HMT at the Spa Little Theater, beginning their 31st season with A Chorus Line, weekends October 9th through 25th at the Spa Little Theater, Saratoga Spa State Park, homemadetheater.org. Autobahn Service, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, offering service, repair, and diagnosis of Asian-made and imports, specializing in late-model Volkswagen, Subaru, Audi, and BMW, autobahntechnic.com. Columbia County Tourism, a summer home to classic musicals, theater, waterfront concerts, music, dance, and outdoor films, columbiacountytourism.org. And Bodhi Spa, Yoga, and Salon, Hudson, daily yoga classes plus haircuts and color, massage, body treatments, and facials, scheduling hair and makeup services for weddings, BodhiHolisticSpa.com. Thanks once again to Ed, Ivor, and Barbara for being here. Thanks again for listening. Thanks to Deb Malik for answering the calls. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's a Food Friday. Stay tuned. You like that, Ed? All right, tune in. Stay tuned now for a news update.